Very good, Greg. I especially this last point that you were making about the going on every person. That's I wasn't aware of that, and I really appreciate that. I think that sometimes our brethren, at least that maybe haven't had home studies or gone up against these people, don't understand the need for going into so much and so deep into some of this. In fact, I was studying years ago with a woman in Armstrongism. If some people may not even know what that means, but they're also Sabbatarians. And so I began to study and to work up a lesson. I gave the lesson, and it was a little bit long. And one sister, well, I love very much, said, "As a good lesson is just way too long. All you need to do is read Acts 20 and 7." Well, you get to argue with some of these people, and they'll eat your lunch, They've got a lot of scriptures. In Honduras, there are some things that you are very common to hear. That if one is, if you convince me, then I can kill you. I had a guy tell me that in Honduras. If you convince me of this, then I can kill you. And that kind of, well, I said, no, you can't. You can't even hate me. But if you convince me, I will have to stone you because you're not keeping it. You don't keep it the way the scriptures say. And that I would have to stone you to death. I think sometimes there are so many things that I think are really good that you can take home a little easier than some of these. But in Luke 24, there are three verses that talk about the first day of the week, because one of the things they do is they have to get him out of the grave on the Sabbath. And that's one of the things they do. In Luke 24, three verses which obviously refer back to the first day of the week. And he says, and this is the day that all these things were fulfilled. Jesus is explaining it. But one of the passages that I think that sometimes we're afraid to use that I believe is one of the most powerful is Romans 7. Verse 1 through 3, we're afraid of the no exception position, and we're afraid of opening a can of worms that we'll have to deal with maybe. But he says we are discharged from the law. And you can't deny it. He says we're discharged from the law. And on down in verse 7, he says, he ties that to the Ten Commandments. He says, I would not have known covetousness, but the law said, thou shalt not covet. They try to switch laws all of a sudden, but I think you can hold their feet to the fire on that and they not be able to. There's very good, though. I really, really appreciated your talk.
There are several other arguments from the scriptures you can make to disprove their theory, and it just boiled down to picking which ones. But there are several.
As you probably know, the preterists take the position that the law did not end at the cross, but extended 40 more years and ended in AD 70. That being the case, if that were the case, which I don't believe it is, but if that were the case, wouldn't there have been some instance of these baptized people in Acts 2, for example, still worshiping on the Sabbath day? Would it have been wrong for them to worship on the Sabbath day if the law extended an additional 40 years?
Well, I agree with you. I think the law was nailed to the cross and not extended up till AD 70.
Which, by the way, Randy brought out the fact that in Romans 7 they had been discharged from the law. Romans 7 was written before AD 70. And at that point, he said that you're discharged from the law. Preterism, of course, for its existence, has to contend that it did not end at that time.
Sometimes I hear some of our own people say that the Sunday is our Sabbath. And I believe that is just as wrong as can be, that we do not have a Sabbath as a day given to us to worship. And even some say that we have the Ten Commandments, that Sunday is our Sabbath. And I'd just like to get your stand on that, or what you think about there, if you've come across that.
Well, I did come across it in my reading, and I know that several in the religious world today, that's what they claim, and I suppose that's how they justify to some degree. I don't think they really can, but they're still holding to the Ten Commandments, but not gathering for worship on Saturday. They say, well, this is the Christian Sabbath. But the New Testament doesn't render the Christian, it doesn't render the Sabbath as the first day of the week. It's the seventh day of the week. The first day of the week is not called the Sabbath day in the New Testament. And I think, as Benny pointed out yesterday, you know, in his talk, that's what we need to do. We need to call things what the Bible calls them. And calling the first day of the week the Sabbath day, we don't have any authority to do that. The Sabbath day is the seventh day of the week, not the first day of the week. We could call it the Lord's Day. I think there's enough evidence from the things that took place with reference to the Lord making the first day of the week prominent that we could call it the Lord's Day, but not the Sabbath day.
Just have a few questions and comments.
Only a few?
Only a few, that's right. All right, I'll cut out some of them. One very quick one is that, yeah, Ellen G. White, who was the big Adventist prophet, you know, she claimed she'd gone up to heaven and seen a vision of the Ten Commandments circled. The fourth commandment was circled with a halo, and that was her big evidence as she went around the country. If the New Testament taught it so clearly, why would you need something like that? Of course, the New Testament doesn't teach it very clearly. I'd like for you to comment on the fact that, as far as I see it, when Jesus quoted the Ten Commandments, he never quoted the Sabbath in his quotations of the Ten Commandments. For example, in Matthew 19, yeah, when he quoted them to the rich young ruler, he never included the Sabbath in his quotations. And I just wondered if you would comment on that.
Well, probably for a reason. Now, you know, like I said in the beginning, 9 of the Ten Commandments are given as New Testament law. All the other 9 are given in the New Testament as law for us today. Not because they're part of the Ten Commandments, but because Jesus or the apostles gave them to us in the New Testament, but not the Sabbath day. So the way I understand it, the way I see it and explain it, is that the entire Old Testament law, every lock, stock, and barrel of it was done away with. And the New Testament is a new law. That's what Hebrews 8 says. It's a new covenant. In Hebrews 7 and 12, there was a necessity of a change in the law. It's a new law. Now, some things from the Old Testament are given by Christ as our law for today, or given by the apostles as our law for today, but it's because they were given, it's because it was given by them, not because it was Old Testament. And I think there's just no authority for the Sabbath today. Jesus didn't mention it. There's no teaching in the New Testament that says implicitly or explicitly that the Sabbath is the day that we need to worship or are commanded. It's not wrong to gather together for a worship service during a gospel meeting or something of that nature on Saturday or any other day of the week. But there's a day we're commanded, and that's the first day of the week.
Jesus was asked in Matthew chapter 22, what is the greatest commandment of all? And he said the greatest of all the commandments is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second greatest is to love your neighbor as yourself. Neither one of those two commandments are on the two tables of stone. In fact, Jesus said all the law and the prophets hinge on those laws. So the Ten Commandments are not the greatest. They depend on the two greatest. Then in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6, you read this in your lesson, who has also made us sufficient ministers of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit, for the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Many people read this, not in context, but they think that this passage is condemning someone for insisting that we follow the letter of the law. And we shouldn't worry about the minute details and letter of the law, but just the spirit of the law. In context, the letter in this passage is referring to the Old Testament, and the Spirit is referring to the New Testament. The reason the New Testament is called the Spirit is because
The Holy Spirit was given on the day of Pentecost when that new covenant began. So just wanted to clarify that. Now, I think that one of the most common arguments used by Sabbatarians to try to prove that the Sabbath still is operative today, they go to Matthew 5, verse 17 and 18. Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. And they read that and they say, till heaven and earth pass, not a jot will be fulfilled. They're missing the point. If you make a chart on a piece of paper and you put destroy on one side and you put fulfill on the other side, either one of those methods will bring the law to an end. And Jesus is simply showing which method he's going to use to bring the law to an end. He's not going to bring it to an end by destroying it. He's going to bring it to an end by fulfilling it. And then when he says, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, he's not giving a time frame here and saying heaven and earth will never pass away. He's using a proverb. If you go over to Luke 16, verse 17, you find Jesus saying the same thing. He says, it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one tittle of the law to fail. And what he's explaining is, it is so certain that the law will not go away by destruction, because it would be easier for the heavens and earth to pass away. It'd be easier for that to happen than for the law to be destroyed. Instead, I'm not going to destroy the law, but I'm going to take it away by fulfilling it. And the second part of verse 18 explains that, till all is fulfilled. One jot or one tittle will by no means pass away until it's all fulfilled. And when he died on the cross, he said, it is finished. And when he said those words, that was the end of the old law. The temple veil rent in twain from top to bottom, and that was it. And it was brought to an end, not because it was destroyed, but because it was fulfilled.
Yeah. You know, sometimes they'll say, oh, it says all, and they're talking about all the things, all the prophecies contained in the Old Testament. They'll say that's what that means there. But if you go over again, Luke helps out with that, because Luke, in Luke 24 and 44, Jesus says, these are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me. So he's not talking about every prophecy in the Old Testament. He's talking about the things concerning him. And if you go over to John 19, and you quoted part of that just now, it says that all things regarding him basically were fulfilled when he died on the... It is finished. And I think there's a passage in Acts 2, 13, some 34, something like that, that... Paul indicates that there too.
There's a little bit of a sidestep here, but in 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter, it has been taught, actually preached, and this preacher studied, not this one, but several years ago, one of the teachers was a brother, leader in the church, and he was assigned to preach on the contribution, and especially 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. And he went through the verse, but he said it was not a command. Well, is it a command or not a command? Of course it is a command, I'll say it up front. But here's what he based his reasoning on. Now the Corinthians, we know, were slow in making up that contribution. And Paul urged them to get on the job. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, he used the Macedonians as an example. They were giving. They weren't rich. They really were stretching themselves to give. And he used them as his example. And then he got down to verse 8. I'm in 2 Corinthians 8, verse 8. I speak not by commandment, but I am testing the sincerity of your love by the diligence of others. So the logic that was used is Paul said, I'm not commanding you to give. And I'm just urging you to do this. Well, that's not correct. And I'll tell you, it must have taken us all flat-footed because three of us that are here today, older preachers, were there. But there was no one contested what that brother said that day. But where's the problem? Well, he said in 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter, as I have given order to the churches in Galatia, even so do you. But still, the King James and these translations doesn't say that's a command. However, that word is used twice in 1 Corinthians, and the first time it is used, the same word, is in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 14. And it's talking about there supporting the preacher.
9:14.
9:14. I'm sorry about that. I'm still in 2 Corinthians. Yes. Yes. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 14. Even so has the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live with the gospel. Now notice he commanded it. But that is the same word that is translated order in 1 Corinthians 16. Now, when he said, I didn't command you, he wasn't commanding them to do something they had volunteered to do. He urged them to do what they volunteered to do. So you don't command someone to keep a promise, but you urge them. And so his argument was spurious. It was not correct. It is a command that we come together, when we come together, and that we come together on the first day of every week. And then in 1 Corinthians 11, as you said, with the Lord's Supper, we keep the Lord's Supper when we are told to come together, which was the commanded on the first day of the week. So I don't know whether you've had someone say we're not commanded to give. We're not commanded to do what we promised to do, that's for sure. But we're promised to give on the first day of every week. So I'll just pass that along, and you may.
Well, and please correct me if I'm not correct on this. But the way I have explained that, and I think we're talking about the same thing here. That passage that you mentioned in 1 Corinthians 9:14, and then also 1 Timothy 5, widows, elders, there's authority to support them. And then here the commandment to support the preaching of the gospel. And there's a couple of other instances of that too. So we are commanded to support the preaching of the gospel. To help the needy saints, those are things we are commanded to do. When do we do it is the question. Well, we have an example in 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. Now, the church at Galatia and the church at Corinth were commanded to gather together and to give. And that's our example that binds us to the particular day that we give of our means. We're commanded to give for these different things. And then we look at that example, and on that day, they came together to give of their means. And I think that's what binds us to do it today.
The command is in the verse you're using. You don't have to go to other verses. The command is in 1 Corinthians 16, in the word order.
My question comes from Romans 14, verses 5 and 6. Yeah, it says, one person esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. He who observes the day observes it to the Lord, and he who does not observe the day to the Lord, he does not observe it. He who eats, eats to the Lord, for he gives God thanks, and he who does not eat to the Lord, he does not eat and gives God thanks. Now, on the observing of days, what is that talking about? Is that talking about like church services, fasting, or holidays, or what?
Well, this is a good question. I believe the context of Romans 14 is talking about liberties. The Bible, basically, if you boil down the teaching of the Bible, the New Testament, we have explicit and implicit. In other words, there's directly stated things, and then there's things that we can derive from what is directly stated. And we have commands, things that, not commands, I should say requirements, things that we are required to do either explicitly or implicitly. They're not options. We have things that are prohibitions, things that we cannot do. There's no option there. We're either explicitly or implicitly prohibited from practicing such things. Then there are things that we are explicitly and implicitly permitted to do, such as the context of Romans 14. I believe he's talking about liberties here, as well as 1 Corinthians 8. Chapter 8 through 10. Anyway, so these are things that we are permitted to do. And so if a person wants to observe a day or eat a particular type of food, I think we have explicit permission to do that. But now with any liberty, those don't supersede a requirement or a prohibition. Or the silence of the Scripture. Silence does not authorize anything. 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17, 1 Thessalonians 5 and 21, and Colossians 3 and 17. If you link those passages together, silence does not authorize anything. It prohibits. So, in a matter of liberty, first of all, we've got to determine whether it is a liberty. If we're required to do something, it's not a liberty. We have to do it. If it's a prohibition, we cannot do it. If it's a liberty, as long as it doesn't violate some other scripture, then we can practice it. So if somebody were to say, well, it says here that I can observe a day, so let's just gather and observe the Sabbath day for worship, as in to eat the Lord's Supper, that violates what we've already looked at in seeing that the New Testament clearly teaches the first day of the week is the day that we're together. So I don't believe that this would be specifically talking about the Sabbath day and that would be a day that we would have to gather together, or somebody could decide we're going to gather together on that particular day and give of our means and eat the Lord's Supper.
And also, you know, Paul, when he was doing his missionary work, when he was about to end it, you know, he went to Jerusalem to observe a feast. What do you have to say about that?
Well, the day of Pentecost is what day?
First day of the week.
And so what would that imply?
The worship service, seeing the Lord's Day.
Yeah, that would be my answer. Somebody could maybe answer it better than that, but off the top of my head, that's my answer.
Okay.
Yes, I really appreciate your talk. There's a passage, and I've heard some say this is a good argument against the Sabbath, and others say that it really doesn't apply. But over in Amos chapter 8, it says, "Hear this, O ye that swallow up the needy, and even to make the poor of the land to fail, saying, when will the new moon be gone, that we may sell corn the Sabbath, we may set forth wheat, and so on." And then he goes on down and says in verse 9, "As you come to pass in that day, saith Lord God, that I'll make the, cause the sun to go down at noon, and I'll darken the earth in a clear day." Is that a prophecy about Jesus and about the ending of the Sabbath, about at his crucifixion? Does that apply?
Well, I believe that in verse 9, that I will make the sun go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in broad daylight. If you go over to Mark 15 and verse 33, I think it's somewhere in there, it sounds like the same, it's talking about the same thing. And I believe that was when all this was going to come to an end.
Okay.
And I think you can use that. Hosea 2 and 11 is another one that's can be used to show that it was going to come to an end.
Just very quickly in reference to the Sabbath, I've heard people say that the Sabbath is a shadow of the first day of the week, and I've always been reluctant to hold that position. I believe the Sabbath is a shadow of our eternal rest, according to Hebrews chapter 4. I think that's the shadow. Is that right or not?
Well, I think that's right. If you look at Hebrews 4, he's saying that, well, first of all, Hebrews is it's talking about Jewish Christians who are discouraged and wanting to go back under the law, and the writer is proving to them why they can't do this. Here are all the things about Jesus and the New Testament and the church that are better than things in the Old Testament. And then during that, he stops every so often and he's warning them. Well, in chapter 3, he has pointed out that Jesus is greater than Moses. And those that didn't obey Moses missed out on the Canaan rest. And so he's warning these Jewish Christians, if you quit the church to go back under the law, you're going to miss out on the heavenly rest.
Right.
And I think verse 9, it uses a word that's only used here. And it's Sabbath rest, and it's the same kind of rest that God took when he finished creation. He labored for 6 days, and then he rested. And that's kind of what Christians need to do. We need to labor doing the work of the Lord and the will of the Lord until our death, and then we'll enjoy that same kind of eternal rest.
So I think that's the shadow involved.
Look forward to.
I don't mean to interrupt you. I heard one of our preachers say some time back that the Sabbath was a shadow of the first day of the week, if I understood him correctly. And I kind of balked at that. I don't see that as a shadow. Do you?
I don't believe it would be a type of the first day of the week, no.
I think it was already answered, but just to clarify, the requirement is the worshiping on the first day of the week, and then any other worship assembly, Wednesday night, Saturday night, whatever, would be the matter of the Christian liberty? Is that how you understand it?
Well, I don't want to say it like that.
Okay.
Just because I don't want folks to get the idea that, oh, we only need to go on Sunday morning.
Right, but I mean, if you were to arrange, you know, another worship, then the liberty is whatever day you choose.
I'm hard-pressed to say to people, I mean, I find it difficult from the Bible to say to people that you have to come to every worship service that the church assembles for. You have to come to eat the Lord's Supper and give of your means. But now, I qualify that with a whole lot of passages that indicate there's great benefit and that we should be there every time the doors are open. Gospel meeting, Wednesday night, Sunday night, whatever it may be.
In Luke 4:16, so he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. In your study, do you have anything to say about when the synagogue began to play a part in Sabbath day observance?
Well, if I understand it right, when the Israelites went into captivity and their temple was burned and they could not go to Jerusalem to worship as they did before, they began to worship in synagogues. Now, it's not really mentioned, I don't think, other than one place in the Psalms. But Jesus going into the synagogue, so those synagogues began to spring up all over, and they began to use that because that's what they could do. Even though the Old Testament doesn't, I guess, explicitly approve that, but Jesus, by going in there, gives approval to it. And Jesus was a Jew under the law, so that would be right for him to do. Is that what you were getting at?
There were some pretty severe restrictions placed on their activities on the Sabbath day, certain things they could do and could not do. And what I'm wondering is, since this practice of going into the synagogue, obviously, which Jesus recognized and participated in on that day, you'd have to say that that was in keeping with the original restrictions that were placed on the observance of the Sabbath, that they could not go beyond what had previously been given regarding that.
Right. Jesus did no sin, and if he's going into the Sabbath, I mean going into the synagogue on the Sabbath, then yes. Just thank you for giving me the opportunity to present this topic, and hopefully it was beneficial. Thank you very much.